This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
One of the things that's happened a lot in my area that I've been working in lately, statistical stylistics and word and authorship attribution, is a big upsurge in interest in those fields, largely caused by work by John Burroughs. But most of that work is based, as was just said, on the most frequent words in the language, often simply picking the 20, 30, 50, sometimes generously all the way up to 100 most frequent words in the text. One of the main reasons for doing that is that, as you can see from this word, this 60-word list, the cumulative frequency is 47% of the words of that novel consist of those 60 words. So that's a good reason for thinking that it might be valuable to look at the 60 most frequent words. They're half the text, and they're not very interesting words, so to speak, semantically, stylistically, thematically, not very interesting, but they turn out to be so much of the text that they are valuable in that respect. And the other reason that authorship people like them is that the standard assumption of authorship has always been that this is the place you should look for authorship markers in the part of the vocabulary that's unlikely to be consciously controlled. Your author may very well control couldn't, but probably, well, that's actually a bad example. Your author may control ratiocination, but is much less likely to be controlling the proportion of. Right? So the theory is that the word print, if authors have word prints, it's likely to be found in this routinized part of the vocabulary that people can't really think about, and very frequently. So this is just an example of a typical novel, Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, 1920. I'll risk one contextualization. The first sentence of this novel tells you an awful lot about the novel. I have it pretty close. On a January evening in the 70s, Christine Nilsson was singing in Faust at the Academy of Music in New York. That novel is pretty well set by that opening sentence. You've got upper class, New York opera, even if you don't know that Faust is an opera. It turns out, of course, she's singing the French opera Faust in Italian for an American audience. And she's Swedish. So it's a typical novel in that it has about 102,000 words in it, about 9,700 types. That's pretty typical. About half the types are hapax legomena, which most people, if you ask them, when you're thinking about word frequency, what do people know about it? Well, they don't know that. If you ask a group of uninitiated folk what proportion of the total vocabulary of the novel appears only once, hardly anyone guesses that it's half. You get people who say it's 1%. You get somebody who will say it's 90%. The one thing that's a little odd about this, you'll notice the feminine pronoun her is pretty frequent in this text. So it's typical, but it's also typical for there to be atypicality. This is also typical. You've all seen this kind of word frequency graph, sort of Zipf's law, that typically the proportion between the rank of the word and its frequency tends to stay roughly the same once you get down past the first few. The content of this list is also very typical, and those of you who've seen a frequency list from, say, the British National Corpus or the Brown Corpus, this is an American novel, so British National Corpus is a little bit of a strange mix, but it turns out 47 of these words, of these 60 words, are also in the top 60 in both the Brown Corpus and the British National Corpus. The presence of two proper nouns in the list is also pretty typical. You'll find novels in which no proper noun will show up in that list, and others in which five or six would show up. Those are all very typical. But even though it's typical, another thing that's typical is the absence of content words. Sometimes people doing authorship or stylistic stuff will actually throw out content words if they find them among their frequent words. You might argue that said, frequency number 37, maybe that's a content word, maybe it isn't. If it's just a speech marker from dialogue, you could argue whether said has got much content to it. A more interesting example is new, Well, let's take like first, fit number 56. Like here is probably only in that list because of the frequency of the verb form. And this is certainly not the verb form that's that frequent. New is very strange. Those of you who've looked at lists of words, to find new among the 54 most frequent words is very strange. Well, of course, the problem is that this is a novel set in New York. So almost all the examples are from New York. We'll come back to that in a minute. To go to the proper nouns, Olenska and Archer, should we delete those if we're interested in the style or the authorship of a text? Is it part of the style of Age of Innocence that one of the characters' names is Archer or not? What about Olenska? Well, if you've read the novel, it is important that her name is Olenska. She's Polish and therefore foreign and possibly strange. So it's thematically interesting. Let me give you an example, not from this novel, but from a novel that I've spent a lot of time on. The Inheritors has the word woman in it 15 times as frequent as the British National Corpus. That's a lot of frequency. It's in the top 60 words in the novel. But it turns out that it's in the phrase the old woman, the fat woman, and the crumpled woman, which turn out to be proper nouns, proper names in effect. They're epithets for people of the Neanderthal tribe that's being described and of the invading Cro-Magnons. And the reason that they're epithets instead of names is that they don't know their names. So they describe them as the fat woman, except for the old woman, who's a Neanderthal, and they don't give her a name because she's the matriarch. I think you're not allowed to speak her name. But you don't know any of this except from knowing the novel. Even if you drop out those name ones from the Inheritors, it stays almost three times as frequent as in the British National Corpus, and that's probably not irrelevant. So the question is, some kind of subtle questions, what do you do about a word like woman in that novel? Should you kick it out? Should you try to tease out the various different uses? Should you take the epithets out and move them? Your example of the words written out as phrases is a sort of related question. And to the question of whether words are stylistic, whether names are stylistic, I'll just give you one thing to think about. What if you had the Wizard of Oz, but instead of Dorothy Gale and Toto, the characters were called, Tiffany Spindrift and Fifi? Is Dorothy Gale a stylistic element in that novel? Is Toto a stylistic element? Probably yes. But do you want proper nouns in your authorship thing? Probably not. Ask yourself, by the way, whether it's relevant that Dorothy Gale is carried off by a tornado. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Now, of course, Archer and Olenska are much less frequent, but you'd be unwise to think that, let's say you had an authorship question where you wanted to know if a text was written by Edith Wharton. If you put all of Edith Wharton's novels in the text, in the test, to measure against your new text, none of them is going to have Archer or Olenska in it, so they're all going to be different from Wharton in that respect. But of course, it's not safe to assume that. You could have, as Faulkner does, characters that repeat from one novel to the next. And in fact, one of the novelists you might be worried about being equivalent to Wharton, Henry James, has a novel with a main character named Isabel Archer. So if you had the proper name in, it might tell you that Henry James and Edith Wharton were the same author because they both use Archer so frequently. And of course, it may not be irrelevant that Wharton uses Archer. She's writing after James and is a sort of protege of James. She may have chosen Archer as the name of a character because of Isabel Archer. We don't know. Part of speech tagging would fix the problem of new. If you could take the proper nouns out from the regular nouns. But it also adds errors. If you do part of speech analysis, you're always going to get some errors included. And I'll show you some poetry in a minute, and I've never found a part of speech tagger that works close enough to being accurate on poetry. My favorite example is a part of speech tagger that says that any word that has a capital letter not preceded by punctuation is a proper noun. Any of you who have seen poems written with the left margin all capitalized will know that you have the word as a proper noun in that mess. The present tense forms that are very frequent in the corpora, has and are and will, are not in this group, partly because it's a novel written in third person and it's typically in past. The narrative is in past. So so lemmatization might fix that problem of having a novel in which the dialogue is in present tense but the narrative is in past tense. What do you do if you have, say, two novels written by the same author, one of which has 10% dialogue and the other of which has 65% dialogue? You're going to get skewing of the author's normal practice, for instance, in present and past. Look at the word I here. It's ranked 16th in this text, the same as it does in the British National Corpus, and that's going to tell you one thing about this novel, that there's a fair amount of dialogue. How do you get the word I in a third-person text unless you've got dialogue? Just as a side example, if I take only the first 50,000 words to go back to word size, roughly the first 50,000 words, one thing you didn't mention about the 2,000 is even if you had 16 people counting the 2,000, they wouldn't all come up with the same number, let alone programs coming up with the same number. I turns out to be the 16th most frequent word in the first 50,000 words of The Age of Innocence. Another novel that I played around with for a while is Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, and it ranks 601st in the first 50,000 words of The Jungle compared to 16th. Well, that's pretty strange. Especially, I can't resist the example, especially since four of those eight, it appears eight times in the first 50,000 of Sinclair Lewis's The Jungle, four of them are in the same sentence repeated. And those of you who've read another text that I won't mention, you can tell me what it is. The sentence is, "I will work harder." Anybody know that sentence from another novel? Accidentally, we don't have anybody who does. Animal Farm. And in fact, Orwell stole it from Upton Sinclair. "I will work harder" is Boxer, the horse's mantra. When anything goes wrong, Boxer will work harder. But of course, in Sinclair Lewis' socialist manifesto against the meatpacking industry written in the 20s in the United States, the main character will work harder, and he succeeds. He wins. But of course, Boxer goes to the glue factory. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with Orwell. Context is all, again. I sometimes even ranks first in a novel. Some 18th century novels have I as the most frequent word, which will surprise some of you who are used to the as always the most frequent. In Pamela, the is actually the fourth most frequent word, after I, and to. Fanny Burney's Evelina, it's the third most frequent after I and to. And in a couple of other novels, it's first. Moll Flanders, it's the first most common. So you might think, well, Moll Flanders is an autobiography. But if you go look at autobiographies, I is not the most frequent word. So who knows? So I've been trying to fix some of the problems of even a very simple word list like this by taking out dialogue to avoid the problem of past, present, and avoid the problem of, say, speech markers, all kinds of things that are different in dialogue than they are in narrative. So I'm only dealing with narrative frequently. But it's very tedious and difficult to do that. Anybody who's ever tried to remove dialogue from a text automatically, you'll find that it doesn't work. At least I've never found an electronic text which has the quotation marks matched correctly. So you can't even cut from one quotation mark to the next. You'll get 100 pages that's dialogue because there's an error in the opening and closing. For instance, you get two single quotation marks next to each other instead of a double quote, which throws the whole thing off. So it's very tedious and nasty. In one novel I've been working on recently, it's an 18th century American epistolary novel. You probably didn't know there was such a thing. Not a very good novel either. But it doesn't even indicate dialogue in the text at all. It's not marked typographically. So you have to read through the novel sentence by sentence and try to guess which things are direct speech. You could mark it for a part of for a speech and thought presentation, but I'm not going there. Largely because I'm often dealing with very large corpora, to my mind, very large corpora for being individually created and then analyzed, 2 or 3 million words, 5 million words. You don't want to annotate that by hand, at least not if you're doing 4 or 5 of them a year. I usually take out personal pronouns. That's a non-standard practice in that partly if you're only using the 60 most frequent words, it turns out if you take out the pronouns, you actually usually get worse results than if you leave them in because there's so much information in them and they're so frequent. If you take them out of this small list, it actually spoils the results. And you can think, of course, it's not irrelevant stylistically or authorially that the text has a whole bunch of hers in it. Right? Some novelists, some writers are more likely to have women characters than men. Some are more likely to have groups, so you're more likely to get first-person plurals, we's and us's, in some writers than in others. But I take them out anyway. I also delete words that are frequent because they're only frequent in one text. So Olenska is very frequent here. I throw it away automatically because it's only frequent in one of my texts. It may turn out if I'm looking at 10 or 15 novels, because Olenska is so frequent here, it may turn out to be on the list of frequent words that I would normally be dealing with, but I say, okay, it's only frequent in one novel, throw it away. And typically that's exactly what happens. You get rid of proper nouns, you get rid of place names, you get rid of fantasy words. So for instance, if you had 1984 in your mix, it'll get rid of the word telescreen, because you really probably don't want to say that telescreen is a marker for Orwell. You might want to say telescreen is a marker for 1984. Right? If you're reading a novel and you come to the word doublespeak, you say, ah, that's 1984. It's a single indexical word that tells you the text. You're reading through a novel and you run across Heathcliff and Wuthering, and you already know what novel it is, right? If you read Wuthering Heights, you'll know that it's Wuthering Heights. I've also been going past this list for quite a long time now. Originally, I started moving up to larger and larger lists, up to the 700 or 800 most frequent, then to the 1,200 most frequent, more recently to the 4,000 most frequent words. Ross Clement at Westminster University is going up to 6,000 most frequent words. Now, the difficulty of that, of course, is that there are an awful lot of novels that don't have 6,000 words in them, of different 6,000 types in them. So most of the words are actually zero frequencies at that point. But 4,000 words typically will take you up to at least the 90% level of the total number of tokens in the text. So the nice thing about using that kind of work is that you're basing your authorship or your stylistic test on 90% of the text instead of, say, 10% of the text or 5% of the text or 2% of the text. So I've been trying to deal with all those different modifications of the way we deal with word frequencies by combining them with a new kind of authorship test called Delta, developed by John Burroughs. And he's tried it on Restoration Poetry, and I've automated the process in a giant spreadsheet that will actually do it automatically. And I've applied it to early 20th century novels and to 20th century literary criticism. And I've been working on ways of sort of tuning that method. It's currently being used in a 19th century prose real-life authorship problem. A guy at the Wheaton College in Massachusetts is applying Burroughs' Delta to evolutionary biology questions. He's working on a genetic relationship between a set of bacteria using an authorship tool, which I think is a nice example of turning the usual direction of influence on its head. Usually it's the sciences that we steal tools from. We're actually now getting to mess with the sciences. Whether they'll survive that or not is a different question. I'm also working on a Henry James thing, which I'll give you a tiny sample of at the end, and an authorship problem on the late Middle English life of St. Radegund, trying to work out ways to deal with problems where there are too small a number of texts and where you've got difficulties of spelling, regularization, scribal problems, etc. We tried it on the Chaucer manuscript scribes, and there are huge problems with that. I'm going to talk just very shortly about a corpus of 46. No, that's the wrong way. 46. Oh, I missed this, but I'll just let it go by. He and him and her. He him his versus she her. If you pick your novel, you can occasionally get examples where they switch. Usually he and him and his are much more frequent than she and her. But if you go to novels written about women, with women as central characters, you can often get that to switch. feminists can work on the why it's harder to get rid of male pronouns than it is female pronouns. I'll leave that alone. So delta, it's a very strange measure. It's very simple, but it's not simple to understand. So what is delta? Burroughs is working on cases where he's typically working on cases of open authorship, where you have a text and you think it's by one of, say, 20 authors, but you don't know which of them, and you have no way of narrowing it down by any kind of external information. So what he does, he takes his set of 25 authors, in his case it's poets. He takes his 25 poets and he sets a sample of each of them. He then averages the frequency of the whole list of words across that set. So you have a set of 25 authors, you average the frequency of all the most frequent words, in my case down to 4,000, in his case down to 150. Then he goes back and he compares each of the original primary set to the mean, to the average. And that's this bottom line. So these are the six, I have six novelists, I have 46 novels. These are the primary sets. I've just picked one big novel for each novelist, which actually is not a good idea, because if you've picked an uncharacteristic novel, you completely skew the analysis. This is one of those cases where too many authorship people are dealing with sets of texts that they've never read and don't know anything about. So they might accidentally pick the only uncharacteristic novel written by so-and-so, and therefore throw the analysis completely off. But in this case, these seem like a fairly safe set of big Victorian novels, relatively large samples. I'm going to say what this assumes is that Jane Eyre is typical of Charlotte Bronte, that Woman in White is typical of Wilkie Collins, etc. So we take the word the in Bronte's The Professor. This is one of my test texts. I'm going to see whether this method will pick out Charlotte Bronte as the author of The Professor, even though we know that she is. So what the technique does, it says the appears this many times in the mean. We take each of the primary texts and we subtract the frequency in the test text from, we subtract the mean from the test text. And then we turn it into a z-score because, as we saw, the frequencies drop so rapidly that if you don't do this, it turns out that only the first five words count. So what we find out is that in Jane Eyre, the word the is about half a standard deviation below the mean for the whole set. So Bronte tends to underuse the word the compared to the rest of these novelists. And in The Professor, she also underuses the word the, and a little less than half a standard deviation. But if you look at the other novelists, you see that Collins is a big user of the. He's 1.8 standard deviations above the mean. So you would not mistake The Professor just on the basis of the word the. You would say The Professor is probably not written by Collins. Bronte is below the mean. Collins is way above the mean. Dickens is a little above the mean. Eliot a little above the mean. Thackeray way above the mean. Trollope a little below the mean. I'm sorry. I'm reading the absolute differences. Below the mean, above, etc. So the bottom line tells you how different these six are from the mean for the whole set. And then if you compare them to The Professor, you can get a sense of how different is The Professor, how different is the difference between the mean and The Professor and the difference between the mean and the other set. So it's a complicated idea, the difference between differences, but it's extremely simple in the sense that it's based on simply the most frequent words calculated in this way. Now it turns out that in a 5.5 million word corpus of 46 novels, delta is so effective that it's hardly worth talking about. You'll find some errors if you're using less than 200 frequent words, but once you get to the 200 most frequent words, you can go all the way up to the 4,000 most frequent words, and it's all right all the time. Every single example, all the 40 novels are correctly identified by their author. So using large numbers, at least in large texts, is so effective that we really can't tell whether there's any point in trying to tune this method. And I've been interested in trying to tune it. So I wanted a more difficult corpus. So I went to a smaller a corpus, about 2 million words of modern American poetry. And I'll just show you what these various different versions of delta delta, the way you read this graph quickly is that the blue bars are written by members of the original set, and the yellow bars are written by people who are not in the original set. And what this shows is that you have, in effect, some errors. You have the yellow bars inside the blue. Those would be identified as being by members of the main set, and they aren't. So those are potential errors. Or you could look at it another way. You could say some of the blue bars are too far down into the other set that you wouldn't identify them correctly as being by members of the main set. These new versions of delta, here's what happens when you add more words. It gets better. Several new versions of delta, and I won't go into this in detail. I'll just mention one of them. These are five new ways of figuring delta. Delta opposite z says that it's probably more important if the two texts are different from the mean in opposite directions. So it says it makes a hypothesis that if you have one author who underuses the word the and another author who overuses the word the, even if the difference between the amount of the is the same as it is between two other authors, the other author underuses the and underuses the other word, that opposite direction differences probably matter more. So underuse, overuse probably matters more. And another method says that large differences probably matter more. So if you have a novel in which the typical word is way out of whack from the mean, that's probably a better place to look for an authorship marker than in ones that are close to the mean. Well, to test this really better, I made up a simulation in which I hid the authorship of 12 texts, and they're the ones that have the A03, A04, A whatever they are. So there are 12 of those scattered through here, and it turns out that delta gives you some errors. Canal versus Cumin and Stafford versus Simpson in the middle, those are errors. But there are 5 texts that are by anonymous authors that this test suggests are probably by authors in the set. Here are the other versions. They're even better. You now get rid of the errors, and you have 5 yellow bars among the members, which suggest that those are actually by members. Each one of these is substantially is better than the one before. Delta LZ is pretty good. It suggests that there's some kind of a threshold about 3. If it's above 3, it must be by a member. If it's below 3, it must not be. And 5 texts again show up. Well, it turns out, of course, that those are these 5 texts. And in all 120 analyses I do, they're all the same. All of these analyses say that text 1 is by Frost, 3 is by Gunn, Sandberg, Creeley, Kuser, and of course, that's right. Obviously, I wouldn't have used this example if they were wrong. But the nice thing about those examples is that they're what you don't get. What you do sometimes get is errors like Rich over there. That text by Adrian Rich, if it had been a test sample, you wouldn't have gotten it right. But it turns out that it's actually an interesting exception-proving example, rule-proving exception, in that that's a text written about 30 years after the other Rich samples. And Rich is one of those people who notoriously changes their style. So it's actually getting at one of the questions that I think needs to be answered more, and that is, to what extent is it really true that authors have a specific word print in their style? Are they always the same? And here's one last example. I'll just ignore that. That shows you that if the first author is very similar to the second, you get into some trouble. Here's a little piece from some work I'm doing on Henry James, who's another one of those people whose style changes radically. And the interesting thing about this group of novels at the bottom by Henry James is you'll notice that late novels are over on the left and early novels are on the right. And they don't tend to mix. Now, strangely enough, this is using the 1,000 to the 1,990 most frequent words. It's not using the most frequent ones. If you do it with the most frequent ones, you don't get that pattern at all. They mix together. So another thing that's happening is people are looking, and there are several people working on different various ways of doing this, moving up into the middle of the word frequency range to begin looking at words that are sort of moderately common instead of words that are very common or as some techniques do, look at words that are very rare. Anyway, so delta looks like a very nifty thing, and I'd like to see somebody do some tests on it using lemmatized or part of speech tagged texts. So if anybody has a 5 million word corpus that they want to contribute that's already tagged for part of speech, I'd be happy to play around with it. So let me then end there.